Next on our agenda, we have Bruce Kreuter with Artesian Water. Bruce?
Thank you, Todd. I'm Bruce Kreuter. I'm Vice President of Planning and Engineering for Artesian Water Company, located in Newark, Delaware. It's where our home office is. Artesian has been in business now for over a century. We are an investor-owned utility traded on NASDAQ. We have over $200 million worth of plant in the ground that we own, operate, and maintain at this day. We have some 200 employees dedicated to providing the highest quality service to the communities that we serve. We provide both water and wastewater services throughout the state of Delaware, and today we're providing service to a population of roughly 250,000, roughly 30% of the population of the state. We own and operate our water and wastewater facilities. They are operated by licensed and experienced staff. And both utilities, both water and wastewater, are regulated by the Public Service Commission, regulated in two aspects, in terms of the level of service that we're required to provide, as well as the rates that we're allowed to charge to our customers. With respect to this project, we anticipate a water demand on the system of about 1.2 million gallons a day. We propose providing that water through a number of groundwater wells located throughout the property. As a part of locating those wells, we will undertake exploratory drilling and undertaking geophysical exams of that boreholes to determine the aquifers that we want to further explore and to screen test wells in. Test wells are then constructed into those aquifers for purposes of long-term pump testing to determine our effect on the aquifer and the ultimate safe yield of those wells. And secondly, provide us with raw water quality data. What is the quality of the water that we are, in fact, pumping out of the ground? And this is necessary for us to undertake our treatment plant design. Artesian's philosophy is to tap into the deeper confined aquifers for two reasons. One is to avoid potential conflict with neighboring residential wells, and then second, to avoid any potential contamination from the surface from man-made activities. The treatment plant will be located near the wastewater treatment facility, and will treat water to all state and federal drinking water standards. On plant architecture, as you'll see momentarily, we undertake to make it blend with the community. The wastewater treatment site is located in the red, and in the lower right-hand portion of that site is where we anticipate locating our water plant facilities. Those facilities would include the actual water treatment plant itself, as well as elevated storage on the property. You can see that it is segregated from the villages of Elizabethtown community, being on the north side of Ingerman's Branch, providing us with a visual barrier of not only the waterway itself, but also the tree buffers which have been previously described. This is the first house entering the subdivision of Longmeadow in Middletown. It's also a 700,000-gallon water treatment facility, which includes iron removal. Example of the architectural approach that we take to our facilities. Similarly, this is a 3 million gallon a day water treatment plant located in the agricultural area, and actually there's a horse farm across the street. Again, iron removal. And we would anticipate iron removal in the deeper formations that we would be exploring for this site. Where'd it go? And finally, another water treatment facility, million gallon a day, located in the subdivision of Stonewater Creek, just off of Route 5, just south of Harbison, here in Sussex County. Again, million gallon a day facility. And finally, as I had mentioned, we do anticipate the installation of a 1.5 million gallon elevated storage tank on the property. It would be located on the wastewater treatment plant site, again, to provide us with visual buffer and distance from residential communities and the roads. The purpose of elevated storage is to provide us with emergency supply, to provide fire protection, and to maintain the water pressure on the system. And with that, I think I would like to turn the podium over to Brian Carbaugh. Brian is our Director of Engineering Design.
Thank you, Bruce. My name is Brian Carbaugh. I reside in Dover, Delaware. I am the Director of Engineering Design for Artesian Wastewater Management. I've been in wastewater for 20 years and have put together a plan for the Elizabeth.
So you're ready for a shower if you've
been. I have literally been in wastewater for 20 years.
Quite a shame. In fact, I'm impressed.
Come take a whiff. I was in a plant this morning.
You guys always say they don't smell, though. Come on.
This one smells. We got it down to the point where it didn't smell.
Anyway, this is
unrelated to the Elizabethtown project. The proposed wastewater management to serve the Elizabethtown project includes the ability to provide additional regional wastewater infrastructure, including the ability to serve adjacent municipal areas. We have secured over 1,600 acres of land in agricultural preservation, including cultivated land and forested areas for irrigation with treated wastewater in accordance with DNREC and the Department of Agriculture requirements. The I think you've seen this before, this is the Elizabethtown community proposed. This is the proposed wastewater treatment site with would also have the water facilities, and the parcels you see in light and dark green are the proposed irrigation areas, which are both cultivated land in light green and forested land in dark green. Our proposed treatment plant site is located on approximately 75 acres of what's referred to as the Ogles land. It is proposed to have a wastewater treatment facility located in the back, again, away from the roads, an entrance road that would come in off the side, maintained a 100-foot buffer along this property boundary, which is the Ingram Branch. With the facility, the portion of the facility up near the road being the treated water storage ponds. DNREC and the Department of Agriculture have established the highest standards for spray irrigation on agricultural preservation land, with the goal of actually improving the land for the production of conventional cash crops. The required treatment for these projects is the same standards used for irrigation of unlimited public access lands, sites such as parks, golf courses, and the like. These projects require advanced treatment with a high level of disinfection. The treatment system includes biological oxidation, a biological wastewater treatment plant with clarification, coagulation and flocculation, high-level filtration, and high-level disinfection. The purpose of coagulation, flocculation, and filtration is to make sure that you have the cleanest possible water which can be disinfected in the most efficient and complete manner. The treatment levels require include BOD and total suspended solids of less than 10 milligrams per liter, turbidity less than 10 turbidity units, and high-level disinfection of pathogenic organisms. When spraying on ag land preservation sites, what we are accomplishing is recycling precious water and nutrient resources. We're not taking the water and discharging it, sending it down a creek, pulling it out of the ground. We're pulling it out of the ground, and then we're putting it back on the ground, recharging the groundwater resources. And we're irrigating for crop utilization and uptake rather than for wastewater disposal. Some wastewater spray irrigation systems are designed to maximize wastewater application and maximize wastewater disposal. When working under the ag land preservation, we are working to work with agriculture and support the agriculture and crop production. This project has been reviewed with DNREC and the Department of Ag, and both agencies endorse this proposed system in accordance with the standards established for spray irrigation on agland preservation sites. DNREC has also reviewed the preliminary soils, and that review, their concurrence letter is included as tab 10 in your booklets. Picture-wise, this is a picture of the storage lagoons. These are actually treatment and storage lagoons at the Middletown facility, which is a 2.5 million gallon per day facility. Our wastewater system would actually have a more intensive treatment, but the storage lagoons would be similar, large open space storage lagoons. Spray irrigation is accomplished by typical agricultural irrigation. Approximately half of this land is already under irrigation with irrigation equipment in place. The buildings, there will be buildings associated with our treatment facility, and they'll be designed to kind of blend in with the agricultural area. This is our wastewater treatment facility at the Stonewater Creek. Looks like a big ag storage building. This is at the reserves at Lewis Landing, I believe, which again is a barn look. We're trying to maintain our place in the agricultural community. Artesian, as a water and wastewater utility, has a strong commitment to protecting water resources for use, replenishment, and reuse. And that's kind of pictured here, where we have underground aquifers. We bring that water up. We treat it in a water treatment plant, make sure it's ready for use. We allow people to use it. We treat it. We spray irrigate it for reuse on crops. And that allows the water to come back and recharge the aquifers that we need and we use for water supply. Next, I'd like to ask Carl Wilson to come up from the traffic group and explain a little bit about traffic for you.
Good evening, my name is Carl Wilson. I'm a project manager from the Traffic Group, a traffic and transportation consulting firm based in Baltimore, Maryland. I'm a project manager, I'm a professional engineer, and a certified professional traffic operations engineer, which is a certification through the Institute of Transportation Engineers. I have a Bachelor of Science and a Master of Engineering degree. My firm is in the process of preparing the traffic impact statement for the site. Tonight I'm going to give an overview of the traffic impact study process. The first portion you have to undertake in any traffic impact study is to obtain a scope of work from DLDOT. In the case of the villages of Elizabethtown, there's a total of 15 off-site intersections that they've requested us to look at. It includes all major intersections located within 6 miles. Off-site access points are also going to be studied. At the scoping meeting, DLDOT identified 7 background developments that need to be included as part of our study. A background development is basically any approved development in the area that's going to be adding traffic to the surrounding roadway network. Basically, this allows us to have a very comprehensive look at what traffic's going to be like at the build-out of our site. Here's an overview of the limits of our study. Basically, to the north, you're looking at Route 1 up at Cedar Creek Road. To the west, all the way over to US 113. You see where the site is down here. To the south, we're looking at Route 30 and Sand Hill. And again, over to the east, over at Route 1. Because of the size of this development, DLDOT has recognized the need that traffic needs to be dispersed to the arterial routes. And that's why the scope is so large, looking at the arterial routes. To the south, here along Route 30, the scope isn't quite as large, and that's because the majority of vehicles heading to the south are going to be using the arterial routes located to the east and the west. As part of the traffic impact study process, the first submittal to DLDOT is the traffic count and distribution. As part of that, we went out and obtained morning and evening peak hour traffic counts as well as Saturday counts. All these counts were collected during the summer months, which represents the worst case of traffic in this area of Sussex County. DLDOT also requires us to utilize seasonal adjustment factors for our counts, and basically those are for the morning and evening peak hours only, and that just gets traffic adjusted up or down to reflect average yearly type counts. We also developed project origin and destinations for all the site traffic. And that's based on the existing traffic flow and current land uses in the area. This study was submitted to DLDOT and has been approved already. The next phase of the study is the preliminary traffic impact study. We essentially use the first submittal to prepare the second submittal. We add regional traffic growth rates, which are developed by DLDOT to account for other future growth, which might include smaller developments that aren't part of the approved background developments, and also developments that are geographically outside of our study area, but are still certainly going to be influencing the road network. For all the roads we've studied, we applied a 1 to a 3% growth rate per year as prescribed by DLDOT. As I previously mentioned, there's seven developments that we accounted for, in addition to Isaac's Glen, which is considered separately because that's only received a preliminary approval, but it's so big that we certainly have to account for it. We also prepared our trip generation analysis as part of the preliminary traffic impact study. The mixed-use development, such as the Villages of Elizabethtown, is quite unique because it's going to have on-site trips. An on-site trip is a phenomenon where your vehicles are going to leave the residential development to access the retail. It's beneficial to the road system because off-site demand is reduced. In addition, for the retail uses, we did apply a pass-by trip deduction. Pass-by trips are basically trips that are already part of the roadway network that stop by the retail use on the way to a final destination. When accounting for these deductions, we developed a total of 1,796 morning trips, 2,541 evening trips, and 3,029 Saturday trips. And that includes both inbound and outbound trips. This is the most conservative analysis that we have because it doesn't account for any active adult units that may be part of the ultimate site build-out. Right now, we're working on preparing the final traffic impact study. Effectively, that's going to build on the second submittal, which has already been approved. We're going to prepare an analysis using methodology and standards required by DLDOT, and we're going to make recommendations for any improvements that are necessary to provide acceptable operations at each of the intersections. This could include signalization or geometric improvements, whatever is necessary to provide an acceptable level of service, or at least mitigate site impact to a point where the intersection is going to be operating at a better level of service than if the development wasn't built in the first place. And it's important to remember that DLDOT is going to review the study very comprehensively and have to buy into all of the improvements that are recommended. And that concludes the traffic portion of the presentation tonight. I'd like to pass it over to Joanne Andrews.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Joanne Andrews, and I am an associate with the real estate consulting and commercial appraisal firm of Lippman, Frizzell, and Mitchell. We actually are in Columbia, Maryland, and I live 3 miles from where I work. So we are the largest commercial appraisers in the Baltimore region, and we've done work in Sussex County. We have been working in Sussex County. Basically, I wanted just to kind of be brief and talk about a little bit about the conclusions of my market feasibility study. Just basically to say that in order to evaluate really any planned residential community, what you need to do is to look over the overall market context and demographics. And what does that mean? It just means what's the demand and what's the supply and where do you fit in? And that's basically where I would just like to kind of sort of head today into this discussion. Here is the quick snapshot, I think, of what is really driving new housing growth here in Sussex County. Basically, if we look at households, because households are the main users for housing, new housing production and new housing, you see that over the next 5 years, It's anticipated there'll be nearly 14,000 new households coming into Sussex County. And that's really twice the rate of growth that's in Delaware. And these figures do not include people who are buying either seasonal housing or second homes, you know, the people who are nearing retirement or thinking of moving here but haven't quite done it. So basically, where is this growth coming from? Well, about 85% of the people on the increase in households is coming from net in migration from other areas, from the surrounding states. And why are they coming here? Well, you probably know is probably more than me, quite honestly, but from what I could tell in my study, the factors fueling the growth were included. You've got a strong employment base. You've got low rates of unemployment. You've got a favorable tax climate. And you have a very attractive area, you know, with nice agriculture and beaches and a nice climate and all of those things sort of have contributed to this growing environment. Let's talk about supply. I'm done with demand. Supply. Basically, you've got a very strong existing home resale market. Last year, in 2006, there were 3,800 multiple list sales. On average, homes were on the market 80 days. That's really pretty low. Median home prices are growing every year. Last year, it was $246,000 in Sussex County. Milton actually saw a big jump. And there I'm talking about the town of Milton, but Milton saw a big jump to $256,000, which tells me that the area has quite an appeal and that it's becoming a very sort of desirable area. If you've got a strong resale market, I'd say you've got a booming new home sales environment. Basically, these are statistics that are provided by the Hanley Wood Market Intelligence Group. They survey every month subdivisions. They of a certain size. I think it's over 10 homes, and they basically say what are you planning on selling, how many have you sold, what are your prices. They give you this market information. This was a snapshot as of November 2006. At that point, there were roughly, in those subdivisions, there were roughly 17,000 units, roughly 5,500 were sold, and there was in the builder's pipeline, there were roughly another 11,500 units.
I don't see any of those numbers you just said on that chart. Do you want to relate that to?
Oh, sure. I was just adding up those three columns of single-family detached.
Okay,
and
your acronyms mean single family detached,
correct?
Single family attached and multifamily.
Yes.
Okay.
And then I was just to kind of be brief. I just was trying to just add it up all three, just to give you a big picture there.
Thank you.
Future supply. Well, that's another thing you've got to kind of take a look at, using the PLUS system. And trying to talk with various people, I came up with in the area around the villages of Elizabethtown, somewhere between 7,000 to 8,000 units in various stages of pre-development. None of them have the scope. None of this have the amenities. The nearest project that I could come up with that was anywhere to this extent was Isaac's Glen, which has preliminary approval, and that is it is north of the villages. So what does all this mean, basically? And what the most important issue is, what is the anticipated annual new home demand in Sussex County? And based on sort of the review of the historical information and the historical home sale absorption, we've come to the conclusion that there you could probably say that in the ballpark of 2,500 new homes can be absorbed or expected to be absorbed annually over into the foreseeable future. What implications does this have for the villages of Elizabethtown? This is kind of a summary of the recommendations and our conclusions about the project. One, the villages of Elizabethtown has the potential to create its own destination residential community due to its size, scale, and potential amenity package. We think that the majority of buyers will be active adults nearing retirement or retirees. We recommend the marketing effort include a model home park and a first-class sales approach by four national builders. We believe that the amenities planned within the community should be delivered early in the sales process and continue to come online parallel with the residential development. We think by offering competitive market pricing and an amenity package, the villages of Elizabethtown could be expected to sell at an overall monthly pace of 20 units per month. And with that, we're talking about an absorption period of about 15 years. Putting it in perspective, if over a 15-year period, each year you're selling 2,500 new homes, that's a total of 37,500 homes. Over this period of time, this project is planned with 3,700 units, and so you're looking at basically 10% of the market. And we think that that capture rate is reasonable. There certainly is no shortage of competitive units, but on the other hand, the villages have the villages of Elizabethtown has features that aren't found elsewhere, and we don't think that a quality development will have any problem getting its fair share of the market. So that's basically what I would like to tell you about our feasibility study.
All right, then. Thank you.
The next presenter will do the economic impact, and that is Mr. Tom Martins.
Good evening. I'm Tom Martins from Economics Research Associates, or ERA. ERA has been in the development economics consulting business for 49 years now. I've been at their DC office for 5 years now, and 5 years at Ernst & Young prior to that. let's see. Okay, sorry about that. This sheet here just shows the development inputs that we put into our fiscal and economic impact models to come up with our outputs. We've assumed 3,710 units of residential. However, we did not include in this senior living options, so this is actually more the conservative estimate when we get to the fiscal impacts. In addition, we've also assumed 413,000 square feet of commercial, made up of 300 square feet of community serving retail and 113,000 square feet of professional office space. Firstly, I want to cover construction impacts, which is primarily an economic impact, i.e. jobs. The total construction cost is projected to be $860 million. Of that, $558 million is hard costs. And of the hard costs, we are estimating a typical industry average of 40% of the wages of the hard costs will be to wages, which is $335 million, divided by the average construction wage in this area, that equates to 958 full-time equivalent construction jobs for the build-out of this project. And on the ongoing benefits, particularly on the fiscal side, we have the real property taxes. Now, given the inputs that we were able to obtain from the county, that results in $1 million. annual real property taxes. However, doing a reality check, this equates to approximately $270 per housing unit per year, which is according to our discussions with people, is about half of what we would normally expect a housing unit to generate in property taxes. So again, this number needs a little bit more refining, but we think that the number from the real property taxes is really more like $2 million. In addition, we have the realty transfer taxes generating $21.8 million. And then we have the ongoing employment impacts from the retail on site and the office employment that will be provided on site of 750 full-time equivalent retail jobs and 411 full-time equivalent office jobs. In addition, the employment impacts will, of course, result in indirect impacts due to the spending of those wages as they recycle through the local economy. Finally, demographic implications. Again, this is under the conservative scenario where we don't have senior living options included. The 8,455 residents would be generated or would be housed in the 3,700 residential units, of which 1,461 would be school-age children based on school child generation factors we obtained from the county. And again, this is not including any senior living options, so that could come down significantly, but depending on how many senior units are here. Now, the cost for educating 1,461 school-age children would at $9,800 per pupil would be $14.3 million. Now, I must point out, however, that 80% of that cost is covered by the state through money generated from income tax. So only 20% of that would actually be funded locally, which would be $2.8 million. And again, that's on the conservative side, assuming that none of the units are age-restricted. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to John Pardee.
Thank you, Tom. Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, this is the time that we had set aside and you had graciously agreed to postpone for questions, and so we would be happy to open the floor to whatever questions you might have.
All right, sir, thank you. We'll see if anyone has any questions for him. Mr. Burton, we'll start with you this evening.
Just the lights, please. For my edification, could you go to the map and just kind of tell me how, and show me how 1 through 6, I need to see that again. We're doing 6 different hearings. Can you just point to the, where the lands are on that?
It's a ways back yet.
Actually, you know what? Why don't I do this?
Got a map. There you go.
You are. There's a reason why we had all these plans. There are a total of the 6 applications, rezone property north of Route 16. For orientation purposes, this is Route 30. This is Route 16. To rezone portions of the property north of Route 16 to from AR to C1.
So that's CZ-1615, that's number 1 on my sheet here?
I believe so. Let me get this specific. Yes, that's correct. The second application is to rezone, it's also the south side commercial, rezone the south side of Route 16 from AR to C1. Third application is to rezone the north side of Route 16 from AR to HRRPC above the proposed commercial rezoning. And then the fourth and final application is to rezone the south side of 16 outside the C1 zone from AR to HRRPC. And then there are 2 conditional use permits for the spray irrigation, for the regional sewage treatment facility, and then the spray irrigation. Does that answer your questions?
Commissioner Burton, the map that is on the screen now, I think, provides a nice visual to show you what Mr. Davis just explained. You see the commercial C1 zoning on the north side, which is the first application, the commercial zoning on the south side, which is the second application, then the RPC on the north and the RPC on the south, which are the third and fourth, and then, of course, as he pointed out on the other map, the sewage treatment plant is the first conditional use, and then the spray irrigation is the last conditional use.
Okay. Thank you. In the book mentions a 10-year deal, and I've heard 10 and 15, and what will be the phase?
I think the real answer is that what you see in the book is a phasing plan of 10 separate phases, and it's anticipated that those phases will take about 15 years. We're not anticipating at this point that it will be one phase per year. We're actually anticipating that it will take 15 years. When we originally conceived it, we were a little perhaps overly optimistic and thought we could get it all done in 10 years, but after our market study, we realized that it's more likely to occur over 15. So you've got 10 phases over 15 years.
Book mentions there'll be no development in level 3.
That's correct. And if I could, I'd like to clarify a point that Mr. Arndt made. He mentioned that the project is comprised of areas that are level 1, level 2, and level 3 under livable Delaware. And actually, there's only a very small portion of this site that is level 3, and that's the area to the, if I may, step to the screen. Balance of the project is all level 1 and level 2, which tells you that that's, I think, builds the case even more so that this is indeed an area that is ripe for development as targeted by Livable Delaware.
But there's no development in level 3?
That's absolutely correct, and I'm sorry if that was your question. There is absolutely nothing in the level 3 area.
There's one mention in here on an outfall. They recommend
get close to your mic. They can't hear you.
They recommend that you do not outfall into Ingram's Branch to be used as stormwater outlets. Is due to rare species of plants and animals associated with Pemberton Branch. Will that be?
I believe the answer to your question is that yes, that will not be an issue, but I'd like Mr. Frichtman, if he could come forward to answer that definitively.
Will you be outfalling into Ingram's Branch for the stormwater management system?
No, we will not be outfalling any stormwater discharge into the Ingram's Branch.
No, the proposed stormwater management design does not entail any outfall into the Ingram's Branch itself.
I'm sorry. I'm actually being corrected by...
So you're going to have to step up to one of the microphones to figure so it's on the record.
Excuse me. I'm actually being corrected by the project engineer. There will be direct discharge into the Ingram's Branch. There is proposed discharge into the Ingram's Branch. It would be pre-treated through our stormwater management system. Obviously, the level of stormwater that would be discharged would probably be the exact same of what is currently running into the Ingram's Branch, which is probably, from an environmental standpoint, a beneficial aspect to maintain the hydrology of the Ingram's Branch. But it would obviously be pre-treated and taken care of before it would be discharged. So I apologize for that miscommunication on my part.
Okay. And that would be subject to the approval of the Sussex Conservation District in Denver.
There's mention in here of deeding land over to the school. Is that something
yes.
for today's meeting or site plan?
You can certainly ask the question.
Yeah. If I may approach the do we have the pointer?
Yeah. You want to go to it?
Sure. You want to take this one?
In the proposed concept plan, there is an area that is reserved on the south side, immediately adjacent to the existing school complex, with direct road access within the community that would be dedicated for school improvements or would be maintained as open space and forest conservation. So if there is a school that is needed, there is an area for it within the property. It is in the most appropriate location, which is immediately adjacent to an existing school, immediately to our east. If it is not needed, then that area would remain as part of the open space system within the community.
But it mentions that in 10 years it reverts back to the developer?
As open space.
As open space.
As open space. It will be either be a school or it will be open space.
Okay.
Can I ask a question just to follow up on that? If it goes to a school, does that affect your density? If that acreage comes off that HRPC application?
No, it does not.
And there was talk of a fire station as well. Can that be pointed out?
There is numerous opportunities. We have to work with a local fire provider to determine what is their most appropriate location, whether they'd like to be located directly onto Route 16 with access onto 16. There is opportunities, multiple opportunities along Route 16 via the retail and residential to our north. There is also multiple opportunities both on Route 16 and on Route 30 via the retail at that intersection. The most appropriate location for that facility will be determined with the fire department. We have areas within either of those retail parcels that would be ideally suited for them.
But it's one area.
It is one area. Working with them, we'll figure out where they want to be, where they would like to be most, and then we'll obviously provide for that.
Okay. In talking about 16 and 30, and there's mention of a tunnel and a bridge, and are you amenable to that process? There's a mention of a tunnel slash bridge slash getting people from one side of the community to the other side of the community without having to use 16 or 30.
Mr. Davis?
That was one of the identified comments in our initial plus application, one of the plus comments that we received back. Although we obviously look forward to working with DLDOT. From our perspective, we would not like to see either a tunnel or a bridge connecting the north and south sides of the community for a variety of reasons. First and foremost, we believe that it will actually negatively impact the community and its integration into the existing community. We believe we can successfully address access into the community with DLDOT at specific points to address the traffic concerns within the community without having to provide either a bridge or a tunnel crossing under or over Route 16. From a community design standpoint, if you put a tunnel in, then you're really destroying the connectivity of the community and our proposed integration. If you saw the one sketch where we had the retail buildings directly associated with Route 16 to create an architectural character, if you travel further east on 16, you get back into a more conventional retail development pattern where the buildings are pushed back and all you really see is the parking. That's not what we want to see. We want to see the buildings up close to the roadway. It's really difficult to do that and maintain and have a bridge coming over or a tunnel going under. So we are delighted to work with DLDOT, but we really don't want to put a bridge or a tunnel through.
Okay. 30 was addressed during other hearings as a major agricultural trucking highway. What is the plans for addressing that as far as roadways go?
Well, there are two proposed access points on the Route 30 in the existing community. There is one proposed access to on the northern side, located right here, about midway along our property frontage on Route 30. The second is located south of Route 30, just south of the proposed retail. So we are proposing only two access points on the Route 30. In addition, we are fronting the residential uses and the retail uses under Route 30 as opposed to backing them out and providing a 100-foot buffer. Obviously, the farming community exists today. It's thriving. We want to obviously maintain that for agricultural purposes. We recognize that our farms to the north and to our west are going to continue, obviously, as part of the spray irrigation and cropland and whatnot. So we're proposing only two access points. We're providing an extended 100-foot buffer from that, and we anticipate that the farm uses will continue to use Route 30 as they have.
If I may add, Commissioner, you heard our traffic design engineer testify that the preliminary TIS has been approved by DLDOT. and they're in the process of preparing and submitting the final TIS. And certainly I want to make it clear on the record tonight that whatever off-site improvements DelDOT may dictate through that process, we will certainly abide.
One last question for right now. What was the number of affordable housing that was going to be?
The total number of MPHU units will be 400 throughout the community. And as I believe Mr. Davis testified in the planning concept, they will be spread out among the various neighborhoods and among the various housing types.
If I can just add real quickly, as part of the report that you would receive back on Monday, there is a specific section which identifies, from Sussex County, which identifies the MPHU requirements as 400 and the dedication of at least 10% of those as single-family detached. Our goal is to provide the complete variety of homes within the community as MPHUs, not just single-family detached and multifamily, and a maximum of 400.
One last point, if I might. At tab 23 of our notebook that was submitted is the letter from William LaCates, the director of the county's MPHU program, indicating that our proposal for MPHUs has been accepted, and we'll certainly look forward to working with him to flush out the details as the project proceeds.
I have no further questions.
All right, sir. Thank you. Mr. Johnson?
I had hoped he was going to ask all my questions, but he left a couple out. Let's stay with the moderately priced housing units. How do you envision that price-wise compared to the regular selling units, and how do you define moderately priced compared to what is going to be market-driven prices for the other homes? Because this is a new concept to this commission. This is the second proposal we've heard that's addressed it, and so we're all learning.
Sure. I don't know that we're able to stand here before you tonight and tell you that we have specific price points that are available for any particular housing type. What I can tell you is that the program that has been submitted will require us to do that, certainly. But I don't believe at this point in time it's been determined definitively. Mr. Davis may want to comment further.
In terms of the proposed sale price for the units, as was utilized in both the fiscal impact analysis and identified in the market demographic study, which is contained in your report. The average sale price for condominiums was for the multifamily, both multifamily over retail and multifamily, was proposed at approximately 100, on an average of about 175,000 square feet, or $175,000 per unit. Took me a while to get that out. The single-family attached villas, the townhomes, are, I believe, if memory serves me, at an average price of $225,000 per unit. And the average price for the single-family detached residential, both the duplexes and the single-family, if I'm not mistaken, was at $310,000 per home. So we utilize those figures for both the identified in the market demographic study as well as the fiscal impact study. Those will obviously, you know, as this community continues to grow, ideally if we're able to receive all of our necessary approvals as the community continues to grow, those will obviously grow in time with the escalation of the, you know, housing market around there. In terms of the moderately priced housing units, I can't help you on that because I'm not an expert in terms of the Delaware or Sussex County MPHU.
Mr. Johnson, just to follow up on that, how this would work if this were to be approved, would under the ordinance, the new ordinance that you referenced, there would be an agreement that would be reached at some point among the applicant, the department, and one of the county attorneys that looks at that and sets price levels and maximum sale prices established by the department. So that would be a component of all this at some point. You know, I suspect, given the size of this project, if it were to be approved, it's probably premature to put a specific price point on it now, because that's flexible, governed upstairs by the department to some extent.
I guess I was looking more, and I agree, you know, you just can't set a specific price. But looking at their preliminary pricing that they show in tab 24, page 13, I was looking at their preliminary pricing. They were talking about a $450 to $500 for a single detached home. Trying to sort in my mind how that, what would a moderately priced housing or MHPU or MPHU or what that might be for in that ballpark, and how that might fit with what the county ordinance defines.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that the county ordinance takes a look at necessarily what the units in this particular development would be selling for to anybody on the open market. It's more of a countywide analysis that's conducted. And again, that's all set forth in the ordinance.
Commissioner Johnson, if I may follow up, and I thank you, Mr. Robertson, for that clarification. The ordinance does require the developer to enter into an agreement with the county, and Section 72-9 of the ordinance allows the county to dictate the maximum sales price for each of the MPHU units. So the answer, I think, to your question, although we can't quantify and give you an example or a firm dollar today, the short answer is it will be dictated by the county. You'll have total control over that.
Well, shifting from MPHUs to your spray irrigation system, one of the things that I've read in a couple of places expressing concerns about the excess capacity of your spray irrigation system, saying that your system could accommodate 6 million gallons and really you're looking at less than 1.2 million. Perhaps that was part of your hopes to get Milton for your spray irrigation, but I know they address some concerns in terms of whether you're looking to pull in capacity for other developments or whether this would spur on additional developments. With that, you're talking about 1,850 acres. Will that all remain in the agricultural farmland preservation?
The 1,800 figure, I believe, includes the acreage for the sewage treatment plant, and I believe the acreage for the actual spray irrigation is 1,650 acres. 1,600. Mr. Carbaugh.
The spray irrigation land, which is land that's in agricultural preservation, is approximately 1,650. I have a hard number in here someplace. And that land would all stay in agricultural preservation. The spray irrigation provides kind of a secondary level of preservation for that land by making it a perpetual part of the infrastructure of this area. As far as the expansion capability, we do see that 1,650 acres of available spray irrigation land could have wastewater management capacity to 3 or 6 million gallons per day. That said, the demand for that would be determined by regional needs. We don't see it as anything that spurs on growth. Growth development is a land use issue. This would just be infrastructure that could support whatever happens. We know this project started out envisioning wastewater management capabilities to serve the town of Milton and any expansion of the town of Milton. That is not the plan of the town of Milton this time, but the owner and Artesian have not removed that portion from the project. There are also other regional wastewater needs in this area, which this project could help serve.
Can I follow up on that? Because now I'm confused on when you talk about the acreage and the uses for the acreage, and I guess the two conditional uses. You'd said for the spray irrigation, I think you'd said it was 1,600 more or less acres, but the conditional use application talks about 1,739.
1,739 is actually all of the spray irrigation areas plus the 75 acres of the treatment site was included in that, as well as.
Well, what's conditional use 1,724? Because that has the 75 acres.
I believe the way it's written, they're asking for two conditional uses for the treatment site, that it falls under both the spray irrigation and the treatment site conditional uses. Any other wastewater?
Well, this is still dealing with a land preservation. It's approximately 1,750 acres. Is that actually in perpetuity, or is that?
All of that is purchased, is in ag land preservation, purchased development rights, all lands of Mr. Hobby Isaacs, excuse me. It's all, the state of Delaware has purchased the development rights for all of that land. There is a possibility that those rights can be bought back or resecured by the owner. I'll tell you right now, Mr. Isaacs has no intentions of doing that or taking the rights back. And given the integration of this land and infrastructure, it would not be an opportunity for these parcels.
Okay. No further questions?
All right, sir. Mr. Gordy?
Do you foresee this development ever being annexed in town of Milton?
Well,
in the near future.
I seriously doubt it, only because once it gets approved, if it gets approved by Sussex County and built out, that would obviously be up to the property owners. In order to be annexed into a town, the owners of the property have to vote to have that happen. And I don't know that they would necessarily, unless they saw some other benefit, volunteer to be annexed into a town to pay an additional tax, unless they felt there was some additional benefit in terms of service. So I wouldn't say that it's impossible, but it's unlikely.
With that being said, how do you propose having police protection for 8,400 residents?
That's a fair question, but it is obviously the state would be providing police protection in this area. I said, no?
8,400 people? State police are going to provide protection for that?
It would call you back, Ben. You'll be back on the road.
Well, it certainly wouldn't.
Is there any proposal of a security firm there? I mean, there's no way that state police won't be able to handle that.
Well, obviously, we are open to discussing whatever we can do to assist the state police. So we certainly have room for facilities if they.
This is larger than most towns in Sussex County.
Sure.
And they have their own police department.
Well, that's an issue, obviously, that we'll have to address. We can't expect the town of Milton to provide police service, so it's going to have to come from the state. And as I say, we're certainly open to providing land or facilities if that's what it's required, but I think all I can tell you is that we're open to whatever the state would require.
And then off of that subject, to enter the commercial, that would be ingress, egress would be out of the development, is that correct? No entrances on for the commercial on 16?
No, there is.
There is?
Yes, let me just point those out real quick. All right, there is proposed access into the development to the entire community,
right,
off Route 16.
Right.
There is no separate access with the exception of this access point right here south into the commercial.
Okay.
That is the only direct access point from Route 16 directly into the commercial. And that is, you know, we proposed intersection spacing would obviously have to meet DLDOT standards for Route 30 east to meet that. The other access points into the commercial really fall within the community system. For example, this is one of the community access points that comes down. You would have to come over on this boulevard and go up into the commercial. Right. These are the community access drives here, here, and here. And those, once you go into there, then you can get into the commercial.
Okay. Good. Okay. One more question. Looking at the plus comments, I see the Department of Education states that they formulate that there'll be 1,892 students, and your book says 1,461. Anybody can tell me why the difference?
I believe the number that we derived came from a formula used by Sussex County, and I'm not sure what formula the state used, but we...
Apparently they used the formula of their own, Department of Education standard formula, it says.
Well, we used a formula based on Sussex County's experience. It was provided to us by Sussex County, and I think even our numbers, frankly, are very conservative because our expectation is that a substantial number of the occupants ultimately of this site would be seniors who would not impact the schools at all.
Okay. I just wondered why the difference. Sure.
I think the difference is PLUS must have used a state formula. We used a formula based on numbers provided by Sussex County.
That's all the questions I have right now.
All right, sir. Thank you. Mr. Smith?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, it was a comprehensive presentation, but I do have a few questions. I'd like to start with I believe it was Tom of ERA, Tom Ardens. I have a question for you. Sort of following up with what Mr. Gordy touched on, the impacts to schools and policing, you were able to provide us with economic benefits. Were you also under the Ben Franklin balance sheet model? Were you able to compile some figures that would articulate the cumulative burdens of this development on the community?
The only burden that we looked at was school children, since it was our understanding that we already had sign-off from police and fire that they could handle what was going to occur at this location.
So the answer would be no?
No, it's just school children.
All right. I have a question for Todd at Envirotech, please.
Yes, sir.
I heard you state what you and your firm are willing to do. Are you currently under contract? Or are you willing to go into a long-term contract to back up what you testified tonight over the course of this project being established and built out over the next 10 to 15 years?
Yes, we're willing to go into pre-design, build-out, and long-term management contract with the owner.
Mm-hmm. And that's correct. I hate to ask you this, but because I realize your firm, that you are the leader and recognized in this. Is there another firm that could step in and fill your job? For some reason, you and the developer or whatever.
There are other firms that do this type of work, but there are limited.
There will be soon.
Yeah, there's very limited firms that specialize in this type of work in our region. Most of the competing firms are from the Western Shore, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. But the qualifications, are, you know, the licensing experience and so forth, there are not many firms that conduct these types of activities.
Thank you. And one last question for Mr. Carl Wilson, traffic. Mr. Wilson, if you could please just reiterate, I heard a lot of information tonight, just the basic of what the high-low daily trips on this project.
Sure. For the morning peak hour, we're projecting a total of 1,796 new peak hour trips. That includes 529 inbound trips and 1,319 outbound trips. That represents the residents, you know, leaving in the morning. During the evening peak hour, we're projecting a total of 2,541 new trips, and that's 1,555 inbound trips and 1,061 outbound trips. We also analyzed Saturday, and for Saturday it's 3,029 total trips, and of those it's almost a 50-50 split of 1,631 inbound and 1,426 outbound.
Is that based on residential or the residential and the commercial?
That's both combined. And it actually also includes that approximately a 10% reduction for the on-site trips that'll be happening.
Thank you.
All right, sir. Thank you. Mr. Lang.
Earlier this week, Shane pointed out something that he picked up on the site plan. It's the first time for us, and you're showing individual lots with direct access, and their only access is from alleys. And that's something that we haven't dealt with before, because typically we have street frontage lots with secondary access to garages, typically from alleyways. Could you give us a little insight on that and how that works? We hadn't dealt with that before. The one thing that you notice in the very northeast corner of the project, just off of Cedar Creek Road, If it's the same color as it's in the book, it would be the yellow section.
I'm going to try and get back to
Specifically, well, to elaborate on what Mr. Lank asked, under the definitions in the, I don't know if it's a subdivision or zoning ordinance, either way, it's pulled in under the RPC that you've asked for. Alleys are defined as secondary means of access, and so by definition, I think there's a couple down on the bottom that Lawrence is talking about, that's their primary means, and I'm not sure that by code you can have 20-foot right-of-ways, and I couldn't tell from the drawing that you submitted. It looked like there was sort of parking in the actual, it was hard to tell what the actual right-of-way was from the design.
If I can address Mr. Lang's question first, and then I'll come back to that secondary question. In terms of the access, all of the homes will have access via a public street. They may not necessarily have frontage on a public street. As Mr. Arndt pointed out in the open space plan, oops, I went too far. There is a photograph that is included on the open space plan that is, it's this one right here. There are two photographs included on this open space plan. One right here, where you see the homes that front directly onto a public park with no road frontage in front of them. There is a sidewalk that runs along them over on the other side and then back. All of these have direct frontage onto the public park. There are a number of examples where that occurs in the community. I think these are the points that, these are the areas we were talking about. For example, right here.
The one obvious to me was up in the, right in the northeast corner, right on Cedar Creek Road.
These.
Next one up. Yeah, that too, but next one up.
These all here.
They to me, they only had access to
the alley in the back.
The alley in the back.
Correct. And the goal of this is to provide for the trail system in the front as kind of the extension of the front yard. This has been done in numerous jurisdictions across the country, where you're basically providing access to this park and frontage onto this park, which does have direct access to the public roads. It is a very, it's a wonderful planning technique, so these front yards really come out onto these parkland areas, as is shown on this illustration. I think if you look at this, I'd be delighted to show you a variety of additional examples of how that can be successfully handled via fire protection, emergency medical services, and a variety of other things from a public health, safety, welfare issue, to be able to provide access to those units, to those homes, without having to put them on a direct public road. It happens across the country. I'd be delighted to provide you with specific examples about that.
I understand that, but to follow up with Mr. Lank asked, unfortunately, I guess you could say in some respects, we're constrained by what the code says, and while that may make good sense from a design standpoint, how's it going to affect your plan if it has to be 50-foot right-of-ways?
Well, a great example would be that we could extend these public yard or these public lots, out to the public road right-of-way directly onto Cedar Crest, directly onto Route 30, but no driveway access onto them. So there is direct public access onto a roadway. We could, for example, in these areas down here, take this and put a public road in here with an island in the center of it. We could, in other examples, here's another great example right here, where the homes have been set back off that road a good 50 feet to provide that vest pocket park in the front. We could extend either the lots directly out to the public road or just pull this together, pushing this down and providing more open space in the back. We could adjust the plan accordingly to address that. We believe that it is unnecessary.
Well, one could keep it as is, except extend the lot lines and then put a cross easement on the first 50 feet back on everybody's front lawn so that becomes the common land. So it's a cross easement going across the first 50 feet of depth of each of the lots. The lot could extend out to the road. That is another alternative in terms of drawing the lines and getting the legal street frontage.
If I may follow up, Mr. Robertson, we may need to review this at greater length, but I think if you look at the ordinance, You have to keep in mind that the RPC district, of course, is a rezoning, not a subdivision. And so these lots that we're talking about are not actually lots, but rather detached condominium units. And in the code, there is no requirement for lot frontage for those types of units, is my understanding.
Okay. Well, that answers a question that I had. So how are these going to be single-family homes on lots for the, I think there's three or four different types of single-family homes. Are they going to be individual? Because the way you show it, with you're showing lots on here. And right. That, to me, is that they're in fee. You know, they're, in some cases, 55 by 100, 60 by 100. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is not condominium. I mean, I know the multifamilies and the townhouses probably will be.
Right. I don't think they're properly characterized as single family. I think they're more properly characterized as detached condominiums. And under the code, there would be no lot frontage requirement for those units.
Just to follow up on the discussion, though, you're talking about the ownership or the layout relative to the subdivision. What's the fire service said about any of that in terms of access to for fire vehicles down alleys?
Down the alleys? Well, I mean, we've identified that the vast majority of the homes do have direct public access to a public road. I mean, if you go through the plan, you'll see that the vast majority of these homes do have direct public access.
But are they okay with the ones that don't have direct public access?
I'm going to have to go back in and look at the TAC comments specifically to answer that. I do want to get back to another question which was asked regarding the alleys. If you look at this illustration here, the alley is shown as the bottom right-of-way example, and the alley is identified as within a 20-foot right-of-way. There is an additional 20-foot setback off of that right-of-way in the back for a what we call a tandem parking space outside of a garage. So the distance between buildings in an alley is identified here is shown as 60 feet from back to back of buildings. 20 feet on either side would be for parking, okay, here and here, and then 20 feet in the center would be for the alley. In a variety of different jurisdictions, the alleys have been designed down to 15 or even in some instances 12 feet wide, which only allows one car to drive down the alley. Our history and from a planning perspective over the last umpteen years has proven that that's not the correct way to do it, and that really it should be a minimum of a 20-foot right-of-way or common use easement. If it is not a standard public road, then it can be dedicated as a common use easement across the backs of these areas for access by all of the owners within that. If it's not a public right-of-way, we're showing it as a right-of-way. If it cannot be characterized as a public right-of-way, then it could be possibly characterized as a common use easement within the property. Smiling.
I keep hearing you say, you know, other places, and I keep coming back to I'm the lawyer, you know, that represents the commission in the county, and I got to go by what the county's code says. So, you know, I mean,
if the county code says it will not allow anything less than it will not allow a 20-foot public right-of-way, then we would be, you know, as part of the site planning approval process, we could definitely dedicate that as a 20-foot use in common easement for all of the access via the property.
To expand upon that, is the only alley access condominiums, townhouses, single family detached, or detached condominiums, or are there any lots per se, individual lot owned fee simple that would be affected by the alley access?
Well, again, I think this plan identifies that there would, we were showing single family detached lots. Now, based on our discussion, if some of those have to become a condominium, a single-family condominium, in order to provide proper access, then we would obviously associate that. I don't think it's a final determination tonight. I would hope that it's not a final determination tonight, that all of the single-family homes within this community would have to be condominiumized in order to provide necessary and appropriate access to them. I mean, again, this is the preliminary site plan, and if we identify these issues, we'd be delighted to work through them as part of our detailed engineering. If some of them need to be condominiumized in order to address this access issue, if we can extend the property lines in other areas, we'd be delighted to do either of those. I don't think it's appropriate, from my perspective at this point, for us to say that all of the single-family detached homes throughout the community are going to be condominiumized, because I don't think they need to be in all instances. So,
I think the answer to that question is beyond the scope of this public hearing, so I would like to move on. Mr. Lang, do you have anything
else? One more question. There's one parcel, it's a very large acreage, at the bottom center of the site. I have to assume it's got access from somewhere. Is there access designated?
I'm sorry. It is shown. Are you talking about this out parcel directly? Yes. As you can see on this exhibit, there is several hundred feet of public road access to that property through our community.
I mean, it appeared that it doesn't have connection. What I'm going by.
Oh, no, it will definitely have a connection. We have to provide access to that.
Because it appears that it goes through your site.
It does go through. It,
at a different location.
It goes right here.
Yeah.
It is shown, sorry, I'm trying to just everybody. It is shown right here, and that frontage right here will provide access to this out parcel.
Okay. That's all I have.
All right, sir. Thank you. Mr. Counts?
I guess I really don't have a question.
All right, then. Mr. Robertson.
Yeah, I've got a few, and I apologize in advance if I sort of jump around a little bit. I was taking notes, and a lot of them got answered, actually. Just so I'm clear, the final TIS has not been completed at this point. Okay. Just as a reminder for the commission, as we've done in the past, it's probably wise to leave the record open for at least receipt of that, depending on what the commission decides to do.
Noted.
Is somewhere on a site plan that's been submitted to the Planning and Zoning Commission a breakdown of the number of units per application, particularly with the HRRPCs?
No, I'm sorry to say.
There's a breakdown on a large drawing. It shows a whole mess of, or a whole lot of different, a whole lot of areas designated with certain numbers. On the big site plans.
Right. Okay.
It's got numbers all over it, but I'm not sure which phases they are, which you have to sit there and calculate them all out.
Okay. What's the total number? Because I've seen a couple places, two different numbers. There's 4,000 that's used in the proposed conditions in a couple places, and I think in the PowerPoint presentation. And there's also 3,710. What's the number that we're working on?
The number is 3,710.
Okay. Of that number, well, let me back up. How many units are in the commercial applications? Do we know that?
Yes. There are a total of 150. There are a total of 150 condominiums over retail.
Thank you for the condominiums, too, since we just had that whole discussion. And those 150 units are included in the 3,710.
That's correct.
Number.
If you go to the 1 inch is equal to 200 scale site plan, which is included in the back of your report, in the lower left-hand corner is a land use breakdown, which breaks down the total number of residential homes by product type, by those 9 product types.
And that's the residential over retail?
And including the residential over the retail.
Okay. The reason I ask that is because there's, with regard to, this is more for the commission, with regard to the residential application, so setting aside the wastewater, we've got 2 RPCs, which the commission or the county has the ability to place conditions on. The C1s, the county needs to be aware, we can't put conditions on that. So if it's rezoned to C1, like the advice I've given the county any number of times, if it's C1, it's not going to be technically part of the RPC review process or subject to RPC conditions. So keep that in mind.
Can I ask a follow-up to that?
Sure.
Is there, I know they're proceeding under the rules that existed prior to the change in the ordinance, but I guess they'd have to comply with the current rules under the CR, they'd have to refile the application then? They couldn't just...
They've applied under C1, so they'd be governed by the C1 rules.
Applied Park.
Right, but I mean, in order for them to, they couldn't voluntarily develop under the rules that exist now. They would be allowed because they filed earlier.
They're going to be governed by C1 rules. All right. With regard, and this is a sort of an unrelated question. You talked about the water tower. There's going to be a water treatment plant. Typically, the counties place conditions on water towers and water treatment plants, and there's a fairly standard set of conditions that the counties used. Which application is that part of? Because as I said before, there's going to have to be six separate decisions on this, so some of them are going to have to be fairly specific to the application.
That would be the Oakles property.
Which number
is it? Which is... CU 1724.
CU or CZ?
CU. It's part of the conditional use application for the water tower is on the same Oakles property as the sewage treatment plant.
Okay. Because so I thought somebody had said it was down on the lower side. So okay.
I'm correct about that, Brian. Am I not?
Yes. Sure.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, that helps me out. Talking about the conditional uses for the wastewater treatment plants, I guess, specifically, and I guess now also the water treatment plant. One thing that maybe while I was writing my notes I missed, what's the impact of those wastewater treatment, the spray irrigation rigs, et cetera, going to be on the neighboring and adjacent properties, if any?
None. None. All of the effluent will be retained on site and recharge into the ground that is part of those farms, and it will not migrate off site at all.
Okay. If you're a neighbor, what's it going to look like to a neighbor?
Like a typical farm, being irrigated with regular water, they would notice no difference between spray irrigation with treated effluent from this regional treatment plant than they would see if they drove by a farm being irrigated with a typical water supply.
You've applied, you said, for the moderately priced housing unit density bonus. I guess, but since there's also an RPC, really, as far as the density bonus and its HR, you're still within the legal limits on the HR if you get that approved. But one of the things I didn't hear, it looks like, again, from some of the lot sizes, that there's smaller lots and maybe some different setbacks that county council, I guess, authorized. Because it looks like there's some lots that are going to be smaller than 7,500 square feet and some different setbacks and things like that.
As part of the MPHU?
Yeah. Now, I guess that's my question. Because it looks like in like the medium single-family home sites, it talks about minimum lot dimensions of 55 feet by 100 feet. And I think the other one, small single-family, talks about 45 by 100. And I'm just wondering, was that part of the MPHU designation that County Council gave you? Because I'm not sure that go that far down if you're talking about less than 7,500 square feet under the RPC.
I apologize. Are you referring to the application for the MPHUs?
I'm trying to get a handle on what's...
Mr. Davis reminded me, the answer to your question is, and I said this previously, that we have to come back to you. We have to negotiate an agreement
and
come back to you for approval on that. So certainly you will have the opportunity, if the commission and the council feel that those lot widths are not appropriate, to change that.
Yeah, and I guess that was my question, because the RPC ordinance says that you can go down to 60-foot minimum widths and 7,500 square foot minimum lot size, and in the minimum requirements and setbacks for the proposed medium and small single-family home sites, it went less than that. And I was wondering if that was generated by the proposal that somebody made to County Council.
I don't believe that the proposal made to County Council that was approved, as indicated by Mr. LaCate's letter, identified specific lot widths, and it's our understanding that that would remain subject to negotiation and agreement to be dictated by the county.
Okay. If I can just add, those proposed homes are really based on market conditions and the nature of those homes in the marketplace for sale in the marketplace. They're really, we believe that those home types and those home sizes and single-family home sizes are really associated with what we are trying to market to both an active adult and market rate community. So they were not based on
on the RPC.
And how's this, kind of to follow up with Mr. Gordy's question, I realize it's preliminary, but on something this size, just generally, how's it going to be governed? Is there going to be a professional management company? Is there going to be an overall homeowners association and sub-associations? Or?
The expectation is that there will be a series of homeowners associations for each neighborhood, so that as each phase is developed, there would be a comprehensive regime of homeownership self-regulation for each phase. It's not contemplated, although we'd certainly be open to suggestion, but it's not currently contemplated that there would be one master governing body. We're open to suggestion if you think that's appropriate, but our concept calls for homeowners associations for each separate phase. And of course, in the commercial areas, you know, you'll have maintenance obligations as well.
Good. May I ask a question?
Sure.
Could that be difficult by development sections or phases running into other development phases and one HOA not maintaining their streets, for example, as well as the next project? I'm thinking of the master versus each individual phase.
Well, that's why I say we're certainly open to suggestion if the commission and the council deem it appropriate that we have some umbrella governing organization, we're open to that. We would have no objection to that.
I could see a project gets approved. Mr. Fritzman is now dealing with 30 homeowner associations.
Yes.
I think you might be better off with a master at least overriding all the phases.
We will indeed review and consider that. It's an excellent suggestion.
That's all I have.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Robertson, anything
One
else?
Other question Go I just ahead. Want to make Go sure. Ahead. With the proposed phasing, again, somewhere I saw 400, somewhere I saw 450. What's just so?
What we're trying to offer you is a number that's realistic, but also affords us some flexibility. There are some phases in the phasing plan that are slightly more than 400, and there are some that are less. What we did not want to do is handcuff ourselves to the number 400 and then find that as a phase was developed, we were restricted because of a condition that was placed on the development here tonight or through council, holding us to a strict 400. It's an average number, I think, is what we had in mind. And we'd be amenable, I think, to some condition that said, for example, no more than 450 in any particular phase, but requiring us to maintain an average of 400 per phase or per year. So we didn't want to commit you to a number any more than we wanted to handcuff ourselves, but the concept is 3,710 units at an average of 400 a year. Now that's, you know, maybe a little high, but the problem is that some of the phases have slightly more than 400 units in them.
Yeah, the purpose of my question was, and I understand that, was just that there was two different numbers used, and I wanted to know the best we could pin down which one that you were looking at.
Well, if I've answered your question, I hope the average we would ask for respectfully is 400 with a cap for any phase of 450.
Okay. Mr. Whitley, that's all the questions I have right now.
All right, sir. Thank you, Mr. Abbott. I've jumped over you. I apologize.
Good questions,
for that.
Mr.
Any
Lee.
Questions? All right, sir. We
Mr.
thank
Chairman?
You. Yes, sir. Anything else?
Just have a comment for the benefit of the commission, specifically Mr. Gordy and Mr. Smith, concerning some of the costs that are involved. Mm-hmm. In tab 25, exhibit N, there was a cost revenue analysis done for the town of Milton that addressed some of the different expenses that this, the impact of this would have had on the town of Milton had it been incorporated. And Mr. Gordy, specifically for you in terms of the police, on pages 14 and 15, there was an analysis of the impact on the police department. And based on their numbers of 8,455 potential residents, using the Milton Police Department staffing, you're looking at potentially 18 field officers. And of course, that doesn't include the, you know, the supervisory staff, et cetera. So you're looking at a department that's currently probably three times the size of the town of Milton that they have now. That's all, Mr. Chairman.
All right, sir. Thank you.
If I could just add something to that. One of the things that has been talked about.
Let's get to the mic.
You need to get to the microphone so everybody can hear you.
One of the things that has been talked about over the course of the development, it hasn't been finalized, is the provision of private security through the community. So that is something that we would obviously be, you know, willing to discuss with the county in order to augment that. We've also discussed, in addition to the fire station over the course of the development, the provision of a police station on site as well, in terms of providing the full civic opportunity. So that's something we could discuss as well. We didn't necessarily, based on our initial discussions with the county, we did not believe that was necessary from the fiscal impact analysis, but obviously that's a point raised today that we will have to take into consideration. So,
Mr. Chairman, if I may, thank the commission for your patience. I just wanted to briefly summarize, and then we'll sit down and let others speak. As you can see on our final slide, and this tracks in great deal the proposed findings of fact and conditions which we've submitted that we respectfully request you consider. But it should be clear from the testimony and the exhibits that have been submitted that the applications comply not only with the Sussex County Comprehensive Plan, but also with all county code requirements. Indeed, all of the uses that are proposed are first permitted uses in the zoning districts proposed, and the project will be designed in total conformity with all county code requirements, including but not limited to Chapter 72 regarding MPHUs, Chapter 99 regarding all of the various subdivision requirements when that part of the process is encountered, and more importantly, Chapter 115, Articles 11, 16, and 24, which are the provisions of the county code that govern RPC, C1, and conditional use. The application, as I stated at the outset, is enthusiastically endorsed by the Office of State Planning Coordination. We have addressed all of the plus comments, and you see that in the notebook that we submitted. And it's our contention that the project, because it is a self-sustained, self-contained community, and all of the infrastructure is accounted for by the developer, the project will have no significant adverse impact on the town of Milton. If I may, I would like, just as a closing matter, to have Mr. Arndt come forward and emphasize the point to you that this project truly is a model community as envisioned by Livable Delaware.
Thank you, John, and very briefly. The major issue, as I understand it, is this inappropriate location and scale of development, and we talked about it being in the Level 1 and Level 2 and the state and the county comprehensive plan for the growth area and even the town of Milton annexation area. As to density, it's even just taking the development area and all the development that is proposed in there, that's about 5 to the acre, and within the town of Milton comprehensive plan and the state guidelines, they talk about 7 to 8 units the acre, so well within that figure. Livable Delaware has put out a book, a wonderful book, by my friend and colleague Ed McMahon, Better Models for Development in Delaware. And if you go down just to the table of contents, everything I see about this plan is reflected in the book. Conserving farmland and open space, scenic resources, there are 1,650 acres of farmland part of this. Maintain a clear edge between the town and the countryside. That is very. There's no dribble out into low-density cul-de-sac subdivisions that worm their way into the open space. It's a very clear edge. Build livable communities, designing real neighborhoods, which they talk about as being a compact development pattern, walkable to shops, easy bike rides, sidewalks, shade trees, traffic calming, a variety of housing types and housing prices. It's right out of the book. Preserve historic resources, the historic cemetery, the hedgerows, respect local character, new construction, the integration with vernacular regional architectural styles, and finally, reduce the impact of the car. Designing the streets for healthy neighborhoods with traffic calming, providing the trails, the greenways, the bike paths. If there ever were a development that really went down through the checklist of this book, I think it would be this one, which is why I've been very proud and privileged to become a part of the team on this. Thank you very much for your long attention tonight.
Right. Thank you.